The Spirit of Jazz podcast, where music dances with mystery, with your hosts, Bill Carter and Jeff Kellum.
Welcome to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. I am your co-host, Jeff Kellum, and the other host is named
Bill Carter. It's good to have you here. Thanks for tuning in today.
We have a special guest. This is the first time we've had a guest on the Spirit of Jazz podcast. And Bill, you want to introduce the guest and talk a little bit about how the two of you connected?
This is Jamie Howison. He is a priest in the Anglican Church of Canada. He is a jazz lover, and I can already tell he is a kindred soul. I met him through his book, God's Mind in That Music, subtitled Theological Explorations Through the Music of John Coltrane. It is an extraordinary book published on Cascade Books, and we will include a link to that book on our show notes. And Jamie, we're just glad to have you here. Welcome.
That's good to be here. Nice to be able to do this long distance from Winnipeg to that eastern part of the States.
Hey, tell us how you first encountered jazz.
I discovered pop music the summer between grade 5 and grade 6 on an old radio at our cottage, and 1971, and absolutely fell in love with that world. And I stayed in the sort of the rock and folk rock world for years. But I remember a friend of mine in high school said, you know, all really serious rock fans at some point will discover jazz. Interesting observation from probably a 16-year-old. And I had a couple of things along the way. Miles Davis's In a Silent Way, the more jazz rock stuff that really appealed to me. But it was a minority in my collection of vinyl. Somewhere along the line, in the early 1990s, somebody recommended I listen to Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. And that was the gateway drug, I'll tell you. And it has been for a lot of people. And when people want to begin to explore jazz and they don't really know it, I will always direct them to that record. It's so listenable. It's so rich. It has such great players on it. And sonically, they are still identifiably songs, which I think is really helpful for people who don't know that world of jazz.
Right.
So it was that record that did it. Mm-hmm. And then I was in trouble.
And since then, who are some of the jazz musicians who have grabbed a hold of your spirit?
Well, I mean, certainly John Coltrane. And Coltrane was a discovery from the Davis record, because, of course, Coltrane is one of the sax players on that monumental album. At first, I was fairly tame in staying around music of that same period from the Coltrane canon. And in fact, it was probably mid-late 90s. I tried to love Supreme, and I couldn't get my head around it. And I set it down, and it was about 5 years later that I picked it up again and went, oh. Other people, I mean, there's quite a list. I'm looking up at my CD collection. I sort of range. I love that stuff from the late 50s, early 60s. Cannonball Adderley and Benny Golson from that period and those kind of folks. I have a real weak spot for piano trio. So the great Bill Evans piano trio of that vintage, I think, is superb. But then that can also carry me forward. And I find, you know, the Bad Plus, particularly the first few records, just take my breath away. And there's a Iceborne Svensson trio, EST, I think are brilliant. And there's a newer one, probably in the last 8 or 9 years, started recording, Go-Go Penguin from the UK, who are exhilarating.
Have you heard Tord Gustafsson on ECM?
Yep. Love him.
I do too. It's like taking me to another zone.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, you mentioned Coltrane. So let me tell you a little brief story that getting to something else that you talk about in your book. I have a daughter who currently lives in Philadelphia. And one day when I went down to visit, the GPS took me down North 33rd Street on the edge of Fairmont Park. And as I passed the 1500 block, I saw on my left a historical marker and a small mural of a familiar saxophonist. And I thought, oh my God, traffic was heavy. I couldn't stop. But I realized that was Coltrane's house. That was the house, at least his Philadelphia house. So you've done the work. Tell us what happened in that house.
Well, I mean, it's sort of to back up a little bit. At the end of very end of the Second World War, he's conscripted and never sees action. He's all in the States and in fact is a musician in a military band. And during that time does their very first recordings in a not very good jazz quartet. And by all accounts, he wasn't great, but he worked hard. And so through the late 40s and into the 50s, he's getting better and better and better. But it was also the days of musicians looking to Charlie Parker and seeing him as the great hero and being aware of his heroin addiction. And it was too easy to fall into it. And there was a whole lot of musicians who got in trouble, including Coltrane. And he made his way into one of the great Miles Davis quintets in the 50s, great albums on Prestige Records, but he was getting in such trouble that Miles Davis fired him. And that for him was the moment of awakening. So he moved from New York back to Philadelphia, back to that family home. And there's a couple of different versions of this, depending on who you read. In some of the more, I would think, sugar-coated ones, he locks himself into a room and accepts only glasses of water and he faces down his addiction and he comes out clean the other side and that's it. He's just on the ascendancy forever. The other versions, and Lewis Porter, who's a really fine jazz scholar and a good pianist, in Lewis's book on Coltrane, he says, well, I'm not so sure he locked himself into a room. He definitely spent his days there safely, but there's evidence that he was actually gigging at night and then back to the family home and close himself down. And he fought off the addiction and came out the other side clean. And he never relapsed to heroin again. There's some indications he relapsed into alcohol a couple of times, but basically he came out clean, but he was what the AA movement would call a dry drunk. He wasn't drinking or drugging, but so much in his way of thinking had not changed. And so you watch over the next several years where, yes, he's back with Miles Davis, and yes, there's brilliant music being produced with Davis and then solo, but he has an affair and a child is born out of wedlock. At about the same time, he writes his great love ballad to his wife, Naima. There is another extended affair that goes on for a number of years and clearly torments him. If you look at the correspondence that remains, he's troubled. He's quite upfront about that with some of his friends, and there's correspondence remaining. But it's something that happens in the 1964 when he meets Alice McLeod, later Alice Coltrane. There is, at that point, there's this real, what he would call his great spiritual awakening. And that changes him. And that's what A Love Supreme's about. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's looking back to getting free of heroin and alcoholism. But more than anything, it's also looking at this point in 1964 where he begins no longer to be a dry drunk, but actually sober and awake.
Works the program, as they say. Yeah. And, you know, it always kind of was curious to me because I encountered A Love Supreme when I was 17 or 18, couldn't understand it, put it on the shelf. But the liner notes, you know, where he does kind of his little testimony and then, of course, composes that psalm, then does the rest of the Teave in C minor. But the liner notes where he talks about that period of irresolution.
The period of irresolution did prevail.
That's right. It kind of countered that American evangelical myth of you have the one awakening and you are finished. And no, the spiritual life is not like that. You've got to keep going forward.
Yeah.
It actually, it's like that story of Jesus and the blind man in the 9th chapter of John. He has his eyes opened, and that's when his troubles begin.
Yeah.
And that's when we have to go deeper and have to go forward. Tell us a little bit about the trajectory then of Coltrane's spiritual life. How did that unfold from 64 and beyond?
Prior to 64, after leaving the South and leaving Philadelphia and coming to New York, he's beginning to encounter all kinds of other ways of seeing and believing. I mean, he'd grown up in the home of his grandfather, who was a African Methodist Episcopal Zion preacher, as was his dad's father, so both grandfathers. He'd grown up in his maternal grandfather's home, obviously gone to church. This was the landscape. And then in New York, he discovers, oh, there's a whole lot of different landscapes. Naima is Muslim. So he's married to a woman who is in a different landscape. And so there's a kind of a period of questioning and probably just a stretch of time where he becomes more generally spiritually interested. What seems to happen around the time of meeting Alice MacLeod and the creation of A Love Supreme is that there is a real awakening to a spiritual life that he can really own. It is quite clearly rooted, and if you know, you read the liner notes to A Love Supreme, it's quite clearly rooted in the Black church tradition, but not narrowly rooted. So I would make the case that a Christian view of things is the bedrock, but he's not a conventional church guy, and he continues to explore. Beyond A Love Supreme, I mean, if you know, you and I, Bill, both got this record, couldn't get our heads around it, and then later did. But if you think A Love Supreme can be challenging, everything after it is even more so.
Well, it's like meditations. Someone referred to it as he's speaking in tongues. And obviously it's a prayer meeting because they're all talking over one another.
Yep. Especially in the opening track, right? The Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. It's like, what?
Yeah.
But what he would have said is, yes, and all of my music, from this point of A Love Supreme on, is prayer. Mm-hmm. And he was very clear about that. He understood what he was doing musically as being prayer. And it gets further and further out, and it gets cacophonous, and it gets abstract. But it seems that that was the only way he could play the prayer that he needed to pray, was in those abstract terms.
Let me interject just a moment. He's the preacher, but what about the other members of his bands? How did they join the choir?
Well, there's a period at which he continues to play with his classic quartet, which included the great McCoy Tyner on piano, very young at the time, also Muslim. I got to interview McCoy for this book, and it was pretty clear that they didn't entirely understand what Coltrane was up to. They were part of the creation process, because that music is created collaboratively in so many ways. But they didn't necessarily completely understand what he was up to. When they came to record Ascension and he doubles the size of the band, you know, at the end of the second take, because they run it through twice, just straight through, 39, 40 minutes. And at the end of it, apparently, the drummer, Elvin Jones, picked up his cymbal, flung it across the room and walked out of the studio. He was just so done. And it wasn't long before both McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones had left the band to be replaced by others. I think it's probably the later band, which isn't as good as the classic quartet, frankly. But that later band, which is still very good, were people who were prepared to go for the ride with him and follow him where he needed to take them, including his wife.
Well, and Pharoah Sanders and others who... Yeah. Him as this great visionary, part of their attraction too. If I stand close enough to him, I might pick up what he has.
Yep. Rashid Ali on percussion, same thing.
Wow. Well, Well, talking with my friend Dave Liebman, who has played some of that later Coltrane music with Michael Brecker and Joe Lovano, he said, you enter this kind of spiritual zone when you give yourself to that kind of music. I'm not sure that a lot of listeners understand that, particularly in an environment where music is turned into a commodity, as music that's supposed to be a backdrop to a nice dinner or lovemaking or something else. This is far more visceral, far more in your face.
Jimmy Green, who's an extremely fine sax player, was in Winnipeg for about 3 years. He taught at the University of Manitoba Jazz Studies program before moving back to Connecticut to teach there. And Jimmy said to me in our conversation that, you know, several times he has, without sort of thinking about it, put on a Coltrane album while he has friends over, and often friends from the jazz world. And he realizes after about 4 minutes, he has to take it off. It's too intrusive.
That's right. And what would you say to somebody who has never heard Coltrane's music?
I suppose the first thing I'd say is, oh, you're missing something. The second thing I would say is, if you're interested in hearing what this guy can do without getting pushed too far to the edge, listen to Kind of Blue, listen to Giant Steps, which is the famous Sheets of Sound. Listen to Blue Train, which is a bigger ensemble. Those are all extremely listenable records. And now you want to stretch a little bit further, you know, that will take you a little closer to A Love Supreme.
Yeah.
Or a song like Alabama from Live at Birdland. It's like, this is so good. And it's a prayer.
Well, it is. And a lot of folks who have heard it don't know that he probably constructed the chant-like melody from Martin Luther King's eulogy for the four children who were bombed in the Baptist church in Birmingham.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a kind of a working theory, and let me work it out with you and see if this kind of resonates. You know, when I heard Giant Steps, I was in college, and it was simply overwhelming that someone play that fast, play that clearly, and play on difficult music like the title tune. And later it kind of struck me that this is kind of the pinnacle of bebop. As the music developed harmonically, the chords are jumping around in minor thirds and fifths. The tempos are up there. A tune like Countdown is nearly impossible for a schmo like me to play. But I had heard stories about how hard he worked and how hard he labored. My jazz teacher, in fact, heard him in Cincinnati. They stopped over to have a drink at the club where Coltrane was playing in the afternoon. They could hear him playing a B-flat major scale, about three octaves up, three octaves back. And that's all he played. And it got a little annoying, so they left the club, and they went back later on, and they heard him with the classic quartet, and it was overwhelming. And then during the break, Coltrane stepped back into the kind of the warm-up room. He started playing the same scale over and over again. He was just relentless in climbing. But then when you compare that to the music that starts to surface in 61 with the classic quartet, develops into Love Supreme, he had kind of moved from what theologically we'd call from works to grace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't just about his labor anymore. It was about floating on the breath of God, or however we might construe that spiritually. And it's extraordinary. The other thing that seemed to happen in him from the accounts, Coltrane was a very kind and compassionate and generous human being, very quiet. But that whatever was going on in his soul and spirit and mind also was played out in how he lived with other people.
All the evidence would suggest that he was very kind and very shy. Part of his shyness may have been because he ate candy like crazy, particularly after the addiction. Rum and butter lifesavers, apparently. And he did damage to his teeth. So he was also quite self-conscious about his smile.
Well, and for a saxophonist, that is a dangerous thing. Well, I'm loving this conversation. Tell us a little bit about the book before we wind up. How did that come together, and how can we find it?
I saw in the Christian Century back in the winter of 2008, this little thing in the classified sections for a writing workshop for clergy held at the Collegeville Institute, which I didn't really know a thing about. I knew where Collegeville was, but that was about it. And the mentor for the week was going to be Eugene Peterson. And please apply. And all costs covered to those who are accepted. It's like, well, what the heck? So I looked it up and I put together my simple application and sent it in. And lo and behold, I got accepted. And then the next letter that came was, and please submit your written piece in progress for us to consider. It's like, oh no, I don't have a written piece in progress. What am I going to write about? What am I going to do? And it was the year, same year that I had discovered for the first time the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, which had just blown my mind. So I thought, well, I'll write about that. And I put together a first draft of an article exploring this piece of music and what's going on in it and what it was doing and how it impacted me, and fired that off. And yeah, that's good to keep working on this. So I did. I ended up back talking to the guy from Collegeville who was the director of the Institute and a big jazz guy. And I said, Don, I'm really wondering if this could get expanded into a book. You know, I could take on 8 or 10 individual pieces of Coltrane's music and do the same thing I've done in that chapter on the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. And he said, basically, well, all you can do is give it a shot. So I did. It flowed like nothing has ever flowed before.
It was meant to be.
There you go.
Well, that's great. And how can we find it?
So it's on Cascade. You can get at Cascade either directly through the Whip Fen Stock website or available on all the usual online, you know, Amazons and so on.
God's mind in that music. Well, thank you for this conversation. Anything you want to say in conclusion?
I think I would just want to say that my high school friend was right back in grade 11 when he said that the serious rock fan grows up to be a jazz fan, or at least he was right about me. Not that I completely cease buying other CDs of other genres, but I really do find that jazz speaks to me intellectually, spiritually, sometimes physically, viscerally, in a way that is just such a delight. And I'm glad to have really been able to crack into that through Mr. Coltrane.
Well, thanks, Jamie, for this time with us. We sure appreciate it, and we want the whole world to hear this conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. This is a production of Presby Bop Music. To find out more about Presby Bop, our music, concerts, and recordings, please explore our website at www.presbybop.com. And send us a note telling us what you think about the Spirit of Jazz. We'd love to hear from you. Check in with us again next time. I'm Jeff Kellum.
And I'm Bill Carter. Thanks for tuning in.